By the way, I'm going to put up the images that we looked at on the audio website. And if you ever want to review what images we are looking at that aren't necessarily in the Red Book, and it will be the same idea. They'll be password protected because they're all copyrighted, and the password will be just Thursday seminar. Pictures are up for the Saturday seminar password. Pictures are up for the Thursday seminar. Password is Thursday seminar. Small letters, no space. All of them that we ever looked at. And I've divided them up into two files because they're
in the book, right? I mean, the book that you're using.
In the Beer Cruiser book?
Yeah. How did he make his living?
You know, we were trying to figure that out ourselves. I don't know.
I mean,
originally he was a graphic artist.
Did he have a line of artistic work that he did for sale?
Originally.
But
then we're not sure how much he was still doing that.
Okay. His wife was an analyst, so maybe they lived off of her income. And it sounds like, you know, in this old European tradition, you pretty much inherit the house, so you didn't have mortgage payment. Of course, you still had two kids. It's not as expensive raising kids there as it is here. School is paid for.
Healthcare
is, well, yeah. I mean, I don't know what it is now. I mean, when I was in Zurich, I think I paid $10 a month. Yeah. You don't need a car. And maybe there was some money from the family that they were living from. I don't know exactly, though.
Sounds like he didn't have that to distract him too much.
Yeah, and I think they must have lived simply. I don't think, you know, they had a fancy lifestyle.
Would it be fair to say about what we were just talking about, that the world soul that both he and Philemon are kind of tapping into,
yes,
doesn't give a damn for the personal soul,
right,
and has to be redeemed person by person.
I agree totally. It's a good image. The world soul cares about the survival and evolution of the species, and the personal soul has to say, yeah, but what about me?
That's what I was trying to say when I said God doesn't love.
Oh, I see.
Is this.
Yeah.
So it doesn't.
Well, that's the second column, pretty much, on 344. And I felt the big shift, we're seeing these huge shifts. One, the previous column of drinking wine. Here in the second column, but he's turning the tables on her and pointing up why he has a right to be suspicious of her, where all along he's been in awe of her. And then that goes on in the second column.
Are you on 344?
Now I'm moving over to 345. The second column on 344 is all this. Plea for human love against the demands of creativity. And then 345, it continues. Love belongs to me. I want to love. Not you through me. You'll crawl and beg for it like a dog. You'll raise your hands and fawn like hungry hounds. I possess the key. I will be more than just administrator. I will be a more just administrator than you godless gods.
But he's just saying there, that portion of you that is within me,
right,
will be begging. This is his redeeming process.
Yeah. Another way to put that is, I'm sick and tired of creativity sucking every last drop of my energy. I would also like to have a normal human family, and it's my right to do so. So he's putting limits on the demands of his creative work. Accepting that he will, but also limiting it to not destroy his family. And, you know, you might say, well, isn't that obvious? No, look at Picasso. It's not obvious. And how many other artists? What was the movie I just saw? Rodin, the same way. Just used people. Didn't care. Because his art was primary. Well, we can be thankful he did such beautiful work, which tells us a lot about ourselves. But Jung doesn't want to sacrifice his humanity for his creativity. He wants them both. The gods know no measure and no mercy. They get drunk on their most precious of drafts. Ambrosia and nectar are the flesh and blood of men, truly a noble meal. So that creativity is sucking it out of him, and he's protesting it.
Now, is creativity the equivalent of what the world soul is asking of him?
Mm-hmm. And by creativity, I think we might need to just look at that a bit. It doesn't mean painting pretty pictures. It means looking at the true nature of human life and addressing its problems and seeking new solutions. Remember, the war is going on as he's speaking. This is 1916, so it's right in the middle of World War I. And it would be, how do we creatively address the human tendency to destroy itself? Any of these questions.
And that's a big soul question of the world soul.
Right. Which he, I feel, his work does address. Mm-hmm. But he's also claiming his right to have a cup of tea in the evening.
Both either Tony or Emma.
Yeah, well, I think I may have mentioned one of my Swiss friends has befriended his last remaining daughter, Lil, and she said he was a wonderful father. Despite what you read by all these idiots, she said in the evening, sometimes he'd sit working in the living room and we'd be playing. Sometimes we'd play games together. Sometimes we'd sing together around the fireplace. I mean, he fought to be a human being as well as a genius. The best part was that the conversation started out with her saying, you know, I think she's 95 or 96. She still leads workshops in the Alps on Russian icons, iconography.
Is whose daughter?
Jung's last surviving daughter.
Daughter?
Yeah.
Survives today?
Yeah, she's mid-late 90s.
Wow.
Lives in an apartment on, you know, she's got help, but lives in an apartment. Who's not? And she said to my friend, you know, the worst thing about getting old, I should tell this everywhere I go where they trash on. The worst thing about getting old is I've lost energy rebutting those son of a bitches, quote unquote, who put down my father because he was a wonderful man. So that's from the horse's mouth. No, I think it was bastards. But you get the idea. So that continues for quite a while. Then, first big paragraph on 345. And I think that we could go into all the details, but the basic message is this protestation for his right to human warmth up to where it says, then Philemon approached me. See where I am? Now, apropos the transcendent function, here it is. Look what he says. Both God and man are disappointed victims of deception. See, he's building a bridge between the frustration both of Jung's ego and of Jung's self, of Jung's ego and Jung's anima, of what creativity is asking of him and what his desire to be a father and husband is asking of him. Both have to suffer. He cannot be a Picasso who only paints and disregards human feeling, but he must create and take some time away from a normal suburban lifestyle. So all that back and forth, I demand, you demand, I demand, you demand, I want, you want, here a bridge is being built. Both of you are going to have to listen to each other, Philemon says, and that again is brand new. The eternally rich universe unfolds again in the earthly heaven and the heaven of the gods, in the underworlds and in the worlds above. Separation once more comes to the agonizingly united and yoked. Endless multiplicity takes the place of what had been forced together, since only diversity is wealth, blood, and harvest. Both sides have a right to be, and both sides must respect the limit of the other side.
And that's the answer right there, what you just said, to the one question.
Yeah.
If we could both accept that each has a right to be, and accept the limits.
Mm-hmm. So we're seeing just, I think, enormously important statements which could slip by you, but once you put them in the context, everything we've done for the last 17 years here, it starts to make sense. Oh, we are getting somewhere. Well, again, there's more. But I think that's the main point. Again, they dicker back and forth about each person's goals having a right to be. But one is the pressure of creative, and the other is the pressure of human caring. It's said in many different ways, but I think that's the main idea. Now, we start kind of a new theme on the second column of 345, second paragraph. Let's look at that. You okay so far? You get back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Some rapprochement has occurred. Now then, she said, I want to set to work. So we're back to creativity. Who has hopefully learned her place? But you must build the furnace. Throw the old, the broken, the worn out, the unused, and the ruin into the melting pot so that it will be renewed for fresh use. Old religious, moral, ethical, philosophical views that are no longer adequate to the demands of the time have to be thrown out. And I think among them, or primary among them, would be the prevailing interpretation of Christianity. It doesn't work. And how does he know that? Because if it had worked, they wouldn't be slaughtering each other 50 miles from Zurich. And as I mentioned about, you know, the dead, that's what's referred to in the next sentence. It is the custom of the ancients, the tradition of the ancestors, observed since days of old. It is to be adapted for new use. That's the dead is the truth of old, and the current challenge is to adapt them to new use, not throw them out. Back to his creativity again. Touch the earth. Press your hand into matter. Shape it with care. The power of matter is great. Did hap not come from matter? So I think there's two senses of that. He is to take his ideas now and begin publicly discussing them. That's what it would mean to put them into matter. His ideas should make a difference in the way we live. And it raises the question again, the importance of the body in communicating through our eros what we are to talk about. Hap, which is the creative, comes from matter. So we talked about this. Just here it is in black and white. Now, take a deep breath. We are winding our way to the seven sermons to the dead. That is just a name given to a couple of pages in this section called the Scrutinies. And he starts to prepare us for the worldview that these sermons will occur in. That would be another way to talk about what it is to put the thoughts in matter. He says, not here, but we see it in a couple of pages later, that what he put in the seven sermons of the dead contain all his future ideas in completely metaphorical language. We got to try to extract a linear understanding out of this bizarre collection of imagistic thoughts. So, I did as my soul advised and formed in matter the thoughts that she gave me. I think most immediately that refers to the seven sermons that are coming up. As I also said, I think it refers just to realizing he has to share his ideas and have them make a difference in the material world. She spoke often and at length to me about the wisdom that lies behind us. Our footnote says, see Appendix C. January 16th, this is a preliminary sketch of the cosmology of the seven sermons. Jung's reference to forming his soul's thoughts in matter seems to refer to the composition of the Systema Munditionis. Appendix A. What we're going to do now is take an excursion to both those appendices, because they set the stage for the seven sermons. And the figure who appears is Abraxas. You with me? It's sort of convoluted, but it gets worse. So we'll go ahead. I know I should have told you to read these, but I didn't realize until the last minute that I think it would be actually good to look at that stuff before we do the seven sermons. And so that is on page there's no page number on it. It's Appendix C, which is essentially it's page 370. Let me set the stage, and then Jane's going to take over. She's very kindly done some work. Jane, if you need more time, we'll start it today. You can finish it next time. I did want to set the stage. Now, this is from the Black Book. And he could have left it off. The reason he includes it is it does sort of begin to orient our thinking towards the Red Book, towards the seven sermons that are coming up. What I wanted to talk about is these three, what's he called, the three ages. That, I'm pretty sure, is a reference to Joachim of Flora. That name isn't important, but this fellow Joachim was about a 12th century cleric who said that history is made up of three phases, three ages. The first is the age of the Father, the second is the age of the Son, and the third is the age of the Holy Spirit. Now, the age of the Father would refer to Judaism. The age of the Son would refer to Christianity. Well, I think why you like Joachim so much is, you know, 1,000 years ago, a cleric said, there will be a day when Christianity ends, as we know it. And that is the age of the Spirit, where we will no longer find our relationship to God through the church, but we will find our relationship to God directly. You can see that's exactly what Jung is doing. He is working through all the Christian forms and showing how they are part of an inner process. So that's what, that's the third age that will follow. And that's what Jung is working on trying to describe. And the image that comes up as soon as he does that is Abraxas, who we don't get the name till the second column, but is a figure that, I'm going to read it, is God an animal? I bind the above with the below. See where I am? The first column, fourth paragraph. I bind the above with the below. I bind God and animal. See, that's a little bit to your question, Barbara, that this new image of God isn't just a spiritual being. It's a spiritual and instinctual being. Something in me is part animal, part God, and a third part human. Below you serpent, within you man, and above you God. And the serpent, beyond the serpent comes the phallus, then the earth, then the moon, and finally the coldness and emptiness of outer space. Above you comes the dove, or the celestial soul, in which love and foresight are united, just as poison and shrewdness are united in the serpent. Shrewdness is the devil's understanding, which always detects smaller things and finds chinks where you suspect none. That's going to be kind of the worldview of the seven sermons, that there are different layers. We'll look at a mandala next, which those are diagrams. I don't think you have to worry about all the details. Just be aware that suddenly God isn't one thing anymore. God isn't law. God isn't love. God is a mixture of everything. Also, what he writes here is the black book. He's going to change his ideas somewhat by the time they get to the red book. So be careful about getting confused. The big divinity that appears on the second column is Abraxas. You should worship only one God. The other gods are unimportant. Abraxas is to be feared. See where I am, the middle of the second column.
I don't have those pages.
Well, Jane's going to take off from here. Abraxas here is talked about as one of the gods. When we get to the red book in the seven sermons, you'll see he's discussed more as the one God. That's the only point of confusion. But Jane has dug around in the vision seminar. I think I emailed you, hopefully. Everyone get the email? What, Jane's papers?
Do you have that in the paper?
When did you send that?
I sent it.
When?
Last week.
Oh, no, I haven't been on my...
Knowing I'm dealing with a group of intuitives, I just happen to have made some copies.
That's good.
You got one, Ann. You don't, Barb.
No, I don't.
Not for everyone, or what?
I've got mine.
Okay. So it's two pages?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you want to go ahead, then?
Yeah. Okay. I will put up here a picture of Abraxas.
Okay.
And Jane, if you want to take, I also put Ion in. I also put that in.
Stay there.
Here.
Yeah.
And then I put in your.
Okay.
So you can put through. And as I say, get started, and we'll pick up next time if you need more time. That goes forward.
I thought we'd just take turns reading some of this, especially now that I've seen this before. But before you start reading, just one second, I'll give you a little background, because I know maybe several haven't seen visions or been through visions. What you're seeing up there is this vision that she had. And what?
Should we kill the lights, maybe?
This is,
yeah. Oh, well, you can't see.
That's all right. This is Christiana Morgan, and she had these series of visions, and she would, they're not, she didn't really go to sleep, but she went into a trance, and then she would have these visions, and she could put herself in these kind of trances, or semi-meditative trances,
yeah.
And then she would be able to draw what she saw, and she would describe them to him. And right before she had this one, I just give you a little, prelude to this. She had a vision of a child being born in a golden ring. And they talked about the fact, Neil was talking about the fact that this child is her spiritual child. She's not going to have a real child. In real life, she had one son, but that was it. But this child she's dreaming or has visions about is a spiritual child, and he likened it to the tree, the symbolism of a tree. And she was her whole development, she was trying to go from being totally overcome by the emotions, like Gary's pictures had up there of the being on fire, and into more of understanding and detachment from them, which would be more like carrying the torch. instead of being inundated with them. And in this language, too, they also used a lot of kundalini. So she's going from Manipura to Anahata. And then she had this vision. She says, this is about this one here on the wall. I saw a figure in the sky of a being surrounded by great light. In his upraised arms, he held a flaming bow. Stars fell from his head. He covers everything, a sort of a layer of over all the world, like an inundation. His lower body was a snake which reached down into the seething earth. And about that, just a couple more comments and we'll get to the paper. About that, Jung has said, it is a monstrous being. Human above and below is a snake reaching into the uttermost depths. And one of the participants in the seminar had said, well, it's like the yogic tree, the kundalini. And Jung said, in response to that, he said, yes, the child has grown into a peculiar tree, which is human above and snake below. And now, that kind of leads us into these descriptions of Abraxas. And Anne, do you want to just start? We'll just take the page or a paragraph and read it. And right before, the bottom of the page, where it says page 1039, just put a little line there because we're gonna visit another vision before we get into the rest of it. So, but for this vision, we'll go down to that area. So if you just turn.
Abraxas is a made up name by the Gnostics, which means 365. The number value of its letters amounts to the sum of 365, the number of days in a year. The Gnostics used it as a name of their supreme deity. He was a time god, time and creative power. By the Gnostic point of view, are identical. He symbolizes the identification of creative energy with time.
That's kind of a weird joining together, too. I mean, you probably don't think of that very much, but time and power. The creative power being one. That was new to me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Okay. And I guess numerical values of each of the letters.
What are you talking about? A is one, B is two?
Well, I don't think so. I think there's a different numerical value for each one of those, and it added up to 365. It doesn't explain it in here.
No.
But
that's how I understand it, too.
That's okay.
The idea of Abraxas would be the sum total of all the archetypes or Hindu samskaras. The figure of Abraxas means the beginning and the end of his life and death. Therefore, it is represented by a monstrous figure. Abraxas is really identical with the Demiurge, the world creator. The philosophic school of Alexandria is probably the cradle of the Abraxas idea. The first attempt of that kind, which we know about earlier than Abraxas, is Serapis.
And I just included that next one, the Greek Serapis of Alexandria, as well as Abraxas, clearly, this is what Jung is saying. I should have said that. I don't have all the quotes. I didn't quote each one, but this is all Jung. His quotes from the vision seminar. That's what he's saying in there. And I think with this statement, that Serapis and Abraxas show clearly that they were made by man, is he's trying to say, you know, all our God images are really our projections, you know. And so whoever has produced these visions and these images, like Abraxas and Serapis, is coming from humans originally. Gary, did you do?
Abraxas, is that where we are?
Yeah.
It's usually depicted as a god with a cock's head holding in one hand a shield or a whip, and the other a sword. He is also armed. Then his legs are two black snakes. The feet are snakes' heads that are raised up to the sides, and he usually has an extra arm. The cock's head means that he is the sun bird that announces the rising sun. The gods symbolize the rising sun above and the black serpent, the darkness underneath.
And there it is up there, Gary brought in. You can see the snake kind of splits and the two legs.
Maybe that's the black chicken.
It could be. Because it has a chicken's head, uh-huh. Rooster's head.
Different.
Could you imagine going to Sunday school and
that God, huh?
Seeing Abraxas loves me?
Yes, he does. The Bible told me.
The Bible told me.
I don't know what all those letters mean.
I don't either. I don't think they're Greek. A-A-M-A-M. I don't know. I bet they're more maybe Middle Eastern, I don't know.
Well, it's definitely got some more like characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the points of it. See, how can you say that's a god of love? I can say that's love.
Yeah.
It's everything. You mean to go on, or?
Yeah, let's.
I have your original sheet.
Okay.
Is this 8:30?
Yeah,
we were
812.
See, I didn't. 812. Maybe I gave out the three sheets that I brought.
Barbie, do you have 812?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. So if our patient should succeed in merging with that vision, she would become Abraxas. She would become a 7 days wonder, a woman above, a serpent below, a monstrous thing. Then the light would not be light, nor the snake properly a snake. There would be terrible confusion. If anybody reaches this state, it is usually something like madness. For when the pairs of opposites are too close together, people lose their orientation and don't know whether they are not upside down. They suffer from a complete loss of values and have no idea what is the matter with them.
And so I think that's taking off on the fact that the archetypes are the union of the opposites, and really we can't live them out here. We're trying to discriminate between separating out this is this and this is that to be human. Okay.
Yep.
So that would be an inflation, and the reason people maybe, when you were talking about her having these visions and going into these trances, I thought she's trying to get something from the unconscious that she's not ready for. Kind of like you said, Gary, with that drug use and things that, or you know, people talk about LSD as being a way to open your mind, but it was not the way to open your mind because you were getting too much and you're not taking responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she was doing.
Could be.
Okay. So I think staying with the focus that it is really a true mysterious mixture of the opposite.
Yeah, and a monstrous mixture of the opposite.
Yeah. All right. Linda.
But this bird shows that thought can be a most aggressive and dangerous thing, such as was suggested by the Abraxas vision before. Now, if you look back into history and ask yourself why such a figure as Abraxas is always represented with a whip or a sword or a shield, you find that the God is really warlike. His weapons are like the sign of power. He can use his whip on you. Jesus said in the temple, I have not come to bring you peace, but a sword.
So with the World Wars, we've just taken that warlike capacity and spewed it out here without any discrimination. And so that's really all the wars, I think, not just World War I and II.
Do you remember that one of the most popular selling albums of the 60s?
Beatles.
Santana. Album was called Abraxas. I'll see if I got. I'll try to bring it in and play some next time.
Oh my God!
And it's wild.
Right before, let's see. This next vision. Right before these next comments, starting with page 1039. She had a vision that heat went all the way through her, and a sign or a mark was on the foot of the sole of her foot. And we'll get back to that ion again. I couldn't find an. I looked at, you know, just Googled an image for that, but actually, on the sole of her foot was a Chinese dragon twined upon a cross, and above the cross, the head of a lion. Well, there's the Chinese dragon, and there's a lion. I couldn't find a simple, an image that.
She didn't paint it, did she?
And she didn't paint this one. She painted a lot of them, but she didn't paint this one. But if you put those two images together, that dragon, Chinese dragon, and this lion head.
Where's the lion head?
Up here.
Not very clear.
That's the main coming
That's
out.
That's the main.
Eyes at the top.
Maybe it's the side.
Oh, I see.
Profile.
I see.
That's what she envisioned, this sign or a mark with both the lion and the dragon, the Chinese dragon. It was on her foot, the sole of her foot. So that was her vision, and now we get to this next page, at the bottom of page 1 here, page 1039. No sooner do you go beyond history or tradition than you are permeated by that fierce energy of the animal. Now, can you imagine what happens when you go beyond history and something new begins? So Jung was asking that of his audience.
But beyond, you get immediately into the turmoil. You get out of the most human condition and into a primordial condition where nothing has been shaped or domesticated. And naturally, you experience the whole shock of the limitless blindness of the great urge to live, which is identical with the sun. Our life springs from the sun, so that is forever the symbol of the urge.
And he's trying to give the audience an idea of what is going through her. She said this heat was just surging through her, this marks on her foot. And he's trying to say how strong this force is. It's trying to come through her and to create something new. And then he'll talk, too, about how you're also branded as a criminal if you do that. If you actually bring it forth, just like we've seen Jung, has been so criticized for his work. And I think that one statement there, limitless blindness of the great urge to live, is just that. It just comes surging through us, and we have to figure out how to contain it and put limits on it so it doesn't eat us up or burn us up. Drown in it.
Yeah. In that condition, there is no thou shalt. There are simply many ways, thousands of ways perhaps, or no way at all. It is a perfectly new experiment, and you don't know where to begin. Also, it is a most sinful thing, because the historical condition is always holy, it is sacred, taboo. Many generations have believed in it, and whoever tries to destroy it, it is considered criminal. So you are akin to the criminal. You are in a way destroying what the ages have built up. So this mark, which our patient bears, is like the mark of a criminal, an innovator. No one commits the crime of being unhistorical.
We can probably all remember Prometheus and how he was branded that too, because he stole the fire. Just anything you do, something that's heretofore that had been a taboo, and then he stole it for the human use. And Jung was saying, well, if you do create, just you know that that's probably what's going to happen. You're going to get people's projections on you, and there, some people will see you as evil.
Would this be a good place to stop?
Yeah. Oh.
What I suggest, let's pick up again and repeat a little bit what we did today. What struck me is that quote, which I didn't have, is it 8:12?
Oh, yeah, I wonder what happened there. You didn't...
Well, I didn't, I just have your first sheet.
Oh.
And I just made three copies, so I passed
up
what I had.
Yeah, yeah.
That might be a place. Let's go. Let's backtrack from 8:12 forward next time.
Okay.
Other books will be here, and that will kind of prime the pump, and then we'll continue.
Gotcha.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. So we'll repeat a little bit for the folks that aren't here, and then we'll continue on and have some time to discuss. Because then you can see it's so important.
It is, because I think if you look at that. And you see the snake. That's the first, like, kind of the first section of it. And then you see the, we'll get to that next time.
Okay.
See the snake wrapped around him? The development of that snake into a dragon, the lion's head. The lion's head, and then Aeon.
Is it Aeon or
Ion? I say I don't think it matters.
I was kind of fascinated with that progression.
It's I wouldn't have seen it until you pointed it out. So thank you, Jane. We'll backtrack a little bit and we'll continue.
Sure.
I had you read. How'd you read to
'Appendix C', right?
Yeah. Read 'Appendix C'. Look at the mandala in 'Appendix B' and read the fine print. All of this is just preparatory. And then let me see, where
I think you have to stop at 348.
Yeah, 348.
348. Where do we?
Second column, number 7.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think we'll get any farther than that. I don't think we'll get any farther than that. We'll be eating anyway, so I would say don't worry about reading anything new.
Okay.
We'll spend, take as much time as you want next time, Jane. We really need to digest Frax, because this is his you could say his imagination of the collective unconscious, presenting a new image of divinity. And that's one of the things we've got to come to grips with. All the things that our Christian God doesn't embody are symbolized by Abraxas. And then when we get to the seven sermons, that will be worked through much more clearly. But so this is all background.
And on this appendix B, you don't want to, we don't have to
read. No, just the big one. No, move forward a little bit. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Just the big mandala.
Okay, gotcha.
Because the others are sketches. And then you see all the stuff that's written underneath it. That's what we'll be going through. And it's kind of tedious. I don't think we need to remember it, but to get an idea how he's trying to envision life in which both the spirit and instinct have a place. The loving and the warlike, where they all have a place. And an image of God which would do justice to that complexity. That's where we're going. Okay, thank you. Well, see you too, and it's munch time, so
that's our last class.
Be our last class, yeah.